From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations originating at the National Humanities Center. The centrality of books and printing to the world's cultural and social life is indisputable, and institutions like the British Museum, the Folger Shakespeare Library, and the Library of Congress house vast collections. Among these are items notable for their rarity, a quality which springs from scarcity and special characteristics of printing, binding, illustration, ownership, or publication. But what's to be said for rare books as cultural documents or physical objects in a time increasingly affected by electronic and computerized writing, publishing, record-keeping, and communication? Soundings put that question to two recent visitors at the National Humanities Center, the curators of rare books at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and at Duke University, John Sharp and Paul Coda.
Is there a core here that rare book librarians agree on? They would, if everybody had his all-time top 40, you know, hit parade of rare books, you would all look at and say, here's the ones that if I had my druthers, I'd pick them up.
Well, I think that we all have our favorites. Uh-huh. And we recognize the importance of certain books because perhaps of our own training and our background in the institutions in which we work. I don't know that we're going to get a general consensus over the top 40 amongst all the curators of rare books. We could take a vote, but I'm sure that they would not be a unanimous decision as to what are to be included in the, as it were, the top 40.
Well, one of them would be the Gutenberg Bible.
Certainly that.
and Shakespeare.
The folios, mm-hmm. or even the quartos.
Mm-hmm.
I think we would just have to say the early works of Shakespeare, any of the folios and the quartos, certainly. But then you get an important work like Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass.
Uh-huh.
There are a number of copies of it in existence, but it was such a major literary statement in 1855, having been published in all places in Brooklyn, a major literary statement because in it, Whitman is shifting the shape of American poetry mm-hmm. in the middle of the 19th century, and in a rakish way. And it was reissued very shortly, so in seeking that absolute first edition, which is some of the collector's instincts, is mm-hmm. to have the best and the first. And of course you need an important item to show to your students. They need to see what the document looked like when it first appeared. For example, again, Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass. It's very important for the student to see that it is not in a Dolphin paperback, that it is a quarto-sized book, and it's very thin and rather nondescript, although Whitman did include a number of his own reviews in the back so that it would have a proper reception. But the items in a collection, in a university collection, are going to reflect the teaching and research interest of that institution. Therefore, you're going to have items in a collection of rare books that are not necessarily rare, but taken together as a whole in a collection, in a subject collection, they enhance it. And so, therefore, they take on a value from the collection of which they're a part.
I think John's pointed out something that's quite important. He used the term subject collection, and a term we use frequently is special collection. One of the important collections we have at North Carolina is the Shaw Collection, George Bernard Shaw's collection of writings, letters, memorabilia, and so on. We consider it one of the two or three best collections in the world for Shaw. Now, individually, many of the items in the collection are not scarce, nor are they very rare, nor would they bring very much price on the market. There are some small editions of books that may bring $10 or $15, certainly not the kind of price that an important 16th century book might bring. But the importance, as John pointed out, is the aggregate. This unit of books, pamphlets, and writings by and about a particular author. There's nowhere else in the world that you can match that group of literature and information. On top of it, what's extremely important, I think, for all rare book collections is to save the original as it appears. Because it's not just the word or words of an author or writer, but it's also the format, the way it was printed, published, illustrated, that gives us a very good sense of what the history of the writer in the period was like. And if they can examine the first edition of Shaw and then a later edition, they will see how his reputation grew, increased, diminished, how different decades in our century viewed him, what they thought was important and not important. Now, an author may change between first and second editions, may improve or may change the fact that you really want the second and the third and the fourth editions. Authors may change because of social pressure. A good example is Darwin. The first issue of Origin of Species in 1859 was changed somewhat toward the end because he felt the enormous social pressure that came upon him, even though Huxley was defending him. And I think what we're interested in, as John intimated, is not so much what is done with that text in a critical way, but to provide the text and all the variants of that text, and when possible, the manuscript versions, so that the critics and editors can retrieve that important original.
Has the so-called technological communications explosion, has that affected what you do? Does it concern you? Do you rare book librarians sort of live off kind of squirreled in a corner of the library that the computer people and the word processors are ignoring? Or
I would like to have every bit of hardware and software available for cataloging and indexing rare books. I think one of the things that has happened in the library world is so much attention has been given to author and title that we have not provided the user with multiple aspects of the book itself. And, for example, in our own collection at Duke, we have developed an extensive index that includes some 50 categories that apply to the book in addition to author and title. And with this index, it can be manipulated in such a way that we can produce lists of books printed by, say, Melchior Sessa, or Aldus Manutius and his successors. We can produce lists of these, or we can produce a chronological list, or we can produce a list of books that appeared in Vienna or Venice within a certain period of time. Well, I would like to have available to me all of the hardware and software to provide that information for every user who comes in who has need for it. Now, in addition to that, we have included in our index the names of all important owners as well as all book plates. So we have a record of the transmission of these books from generation to generation of owners.
Who is it? Who is it that's interested in rare books, for instance, to steal them? Haven't there been stories in the news lately about people who have stolen them and tried to put them on the
rare book
market
for 20 years? Yeah, right. We hope there has been increase. Well, as books have increased in value over the last many decades, they've attracted a good many thieves, and these books have. These thieves have been tracked a little more successfully in the past couple of years, and there was a man, or is a man, named Shin, who was recently arrested and prosecuted and received a 20-year sentence for stealing books. And he stole books from many libraries across the country. There have been other instances of books, or even parts of books, which have been stolen. For example, maps, illustrations that can on their own be very important. And I think this is one of the great significant features of rare books, is that physical quality of the book. It's simply impossible through photocopying or through any other mechanical means to reproduce the drawings or etchings of, say, William Blake and the colored etchings. We need and require those originals so that art critics and literary persons, students and senior faculty, can see the techniques and fineness with which many artists worked. And I think this covers certainly the woodcuts of the 15th century all the way up to very modern books.
May I follow up on that just a little bit? Paul's mention of art, I think, is a key, in a way, to understanding the importance of rare books vis-a-vis the technical revolution of or microforms of all kind. I think rare books will be around as long as there is good art, because the approach to the rare book is one that brings to life the period of time in which it was produced. One example that I use when I have groups of students, whether they are grade school students from the local grade school or whether they're freshmen or seniors, it doesn't matter. is to place them in proximity to a 13th century manuscript and ask them to consider the fact that they are in the presence or of a document where other people have sat in exactly the same relationship for a millennium. Mm-hmm. Or less. But the point is that they feel a proximity to their history and an appreciation of it in a way that I think one never gets from a microfilm machine. You never handle a book from any period without that sense of its own presence. And it's like in the being in the presence of great art. Wayne, one of the things about scholarship, of course, it's constantly re-examining what it's already done.
Mm-hmm.
And scholarship brings to light new ways of examining old materials. And I believe that in the field of rare books, we're just beginning to tap the resources that are there in the physical object. We've read most of the text. Well, many texts that are going to be useful again, or they're available in microform of some kind. But the item itself has to be examined for what it can contribute to the history of, printing, social history, technological history. I'll give you an example. I did a little essay on a book that was without the name of a printer or a place of printing. And it took a bit of research to determine when the book was printed, by whom it was printed. Well, many of the determinations as to who was the printer was made on the basis of an examination of the typography. This is a wonderful science that's developed more extensively, with an interest in studying incunabula in early printed books, that is, books printed before 1500. Well, this particular item, by examining how it was put together, now has a history. We know where it was printed and by whom and approximately when, within a range of 4 or 5 months. But it could not have been done without examining the document itself, its contents, which have been examined many times before, its content as well as its format.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations and comments from scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. You're listening to a conversation with two curators of rare books, Paul Coda of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and John Sharp of Duke University.
It's obvious that in one way, at one level, you must think of yourselves as detectives.
That's true.
Stalking an elusive prey. Mm-hmm. Are there famous stories, apocryphal stories in the world of rare books?
Well, there are apocryphal and true stories as well. I think the most famous, at least in recent times, was the discovery that the books, there were, well, let me give you a title of a book to explain. In the early 20th century, a book was published with the title, An Inquiry into the Nature of Certain 19th Century Pamphlets. And it was written by two young scholars who were interested in a series of pamphlets that had been published and seemingly appearing on the market at propitious intervals at very high prices. Through their scholarship and through the comparison analysis of the paper and analysis of the type, much like the analysis that John made on the 15th century book, they were able to determine that these books were not legitimate books. The reason I say that is because they weren't really forgeries. They were not copying something else. What the perpetrator did, in modern parlance, one Thomas J. Wise, was simply print pre-first edition publications on which he had printed on there for private circulation. For private circulation only. And these pamphlets began appearing. They covered a number of artists. Tennyson was one of them. Elizabeth Barrett Browning, the most famous, with the Sonnets of the Portuguese. And it was through the analysis of the physical constituents of the book that they were able to tell that these were not actual publications of these authors. The two specifics were, one, the paper on which they were printed was made of esparto grass, which is a fiber that did not appear in English papermaking until well after 1860. And the second was a particular letter in the type And through this method, they were able to uncover a rather vast network of printing and publishing.
Fraudulent material.
My story is about the combination of technology, the use of technology to identify a book which was long lost from a library in northern Greece, and the library in Kosinitsa. It comes from a place called Ikisophenesis, which means 20 palm trees. We had in our collection a Greek manuscript from the 13th century, and it is a complete New Testament with all 27 books. These are rare because there are only 50 of such known examples in the world. We acquired a manuscript, a four gospel manuscript, that had a peculiar kind of binding that was very much like the binding of our Greek manuscript of the New Testament. I examined it rather carefully to make details of the binding and paleography. Well, the paleography indicated that there was at least 100 years difference between.
Now, what is paleography?
The handwriting.
Mm-hmm.
The study of the hand and identifying a particular period of time with a particular style of handwriting. The paleography, or the examination of it, the writing of it, indicated there was at least 200 years difference between these two documents. The bindings indicated, however, that they were of a similar period. Style, the kind of leather, the kind of wood, the manner in which the covers were sewn onto the folds of the parchment. It was inconclusive until we took the two documents to the X-ray unit, to the soft tissue X-ray unit in Duke Hospital, X-rayed these two, and compared the xeroradiographs and saw that the techniques were identical even to the drill marks in the wood. So we identified these manuscripts as having been, one of them we knew came from Kosinitsa. Number one, our Greek number one, was from Kosinitsa. But the four gospel manuscript, long lost from all the list, having disappeared completely from any list as being recognized from Kosinitsa, now has been restored to the list.
It would be hard, I suppose, to say that one book is the rarest of all. But what kinds of things would fit into that category?
I'll take a chance on the rare one. I think probably the rarest book of all is the first edition of Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress.
Mm-hmm. Even rarer than some of these biblical manuscripts?
Well, now, when we talk about manuscripts, we're talking about handwritten documents, which are unique. Mm-hmm. Each one is unique.
But they are not books, necessarily.
Oh, yes. When we talk about codices, any mm-hmm. book that is folded, that's a book. Or any written item that is designed to convey public information instead of letters, we'll call that a codex book. Uh-huh. Although we may have rolls, a form, but a roll is a book. But we're not regarding letters as books, you see. Now the codex book, we'll regard as unique pieces amongst the printed books. Let us say, the rarest of all. In English, I guess would have to be Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress.
I'd like to disagree.
You may.
I think the rarest is an item called A Free Man's Worship. The reason being, it's never been discovered. The first printed book in British North America is considered the Bay Psalm Book, printed by Stephen Day. There is evidence that they printed before that an item called A Free Man's Worship.
And that would have been early in the 17th century.
Right, 1640.
Can we call it rare if it doesn't exist?
That's a good question. Sure.
And certainly it is. I think every rare book librarian is looking for it, whether bound into another binding.
Something that's rumored to exist.
But I think there's enough printed evidence to indicate that it certainly does exist. I think the Bay Psalm book in itself is also a very rare book. I think there are about a dozen copies, extant copies, very few of which are complete copies. Many of these books, which are exceedingly rare, or let's say scarce, only exist in partial format, several leaves or many leaves. And I think it's also important to to remember that many of the books that were saved, let's say by the Renaissance, right after the medieval period, only existed in one or two copies. So one of the great things that the invention of printing did, and the invention of this technology, was to reproduce many classical works that would have been destroyed or never come to light again. Usually the first appearances are extremely scarce, very often because one isn't aware that it may be an important event. Certainly many of the discoveries in the history of medicine or science were published papers of a short length, and that had an enormous consequence on our world.
And they would qualify as rare books.
I think one of the most fascinating things I've seen is the small article on a theory of relativity that Einstein wrote.
Mm-hmm. It's very small. Are the whole discovery of the circulation of the blood, Harvey's work on the circulation of the blood, any of these are major changes. And I think we are back again to the definition of rare books. They are documents that shift the course of events or shift an understanding of things. But in fact, a book is an artifact that comes from a particular strata of our culture. Mm-hmm. And what we are doing is identifying the place of that particular item within the various strata of culture that have gone on before us, which helps us understand how we have come to this place, whence we've come. I think in addition to this, I think we must recognize that the book itself, therefore, occupies a very important place. And I think I like to think of a book as a cultural emblem. Mm-hmm. And when we are looking at a rare book, I regard it in my own collection, everyone, as important for the artistic, literary statement that it makes and how all of these come together, whether it's with its history, whether it's with its printer, its contents, its paper. But what this represents by, if you want to call it, dissecting or exegeting mm-hmm. this particular document, we are able, therefore, to have a view into our past as nothing else can give us.
Another thought that comes to mind is, even though we can't anticipate which books, which pamphlets in the future are going to be rare, would that we could all retire tomorrow in terms of the stock market, but we do try to develop areas that we have a fairly good idea that are going to be important, or we at least hope they're going to be important. One area that our rare book collection has been collecting is books that were designed, or in which the dust jackets were designed by black artists of the 1920s, 30s, and 40s in America. It's come to our attention that the great many good black artists were working with these books. They seem not to have been noticed to any great extent by the collecting trade, and I suppose I'm revealing our future collecting development policy, but many of these are quite attractive books.
There are just so many things that you have to be sensitive to and aware of. Apart, for instance, from literary merit, you're talking here about dust jackets.
We're talking about the cultural emblem again.
There is a bookseller who's gotten in touch with us recently and said he had about 24 books of a collection he put together of 19th century autobiographies, which doesn't sound like much because the 19th century was famous for biographies and autobiographies, and there were hundreds and hundreds published. But these are autobiographies of persons who spent most of their lives in insane asylums. And the biographies describe what it was like living there, and also a great deal about the care they underwent.
Now, so there's a social and a medical angle here.
There's a medical, there's a social, there's possibly in the history of biography, we don't know yet, mm-hmm. a number of ways of looking at a society that had not been thought of before. And of course, this was the first time that the care for persons who were psychologically disturbed began to improve and to change quite rapidly.
To go one step further to a more contemporary example, Glenn Negley put together a collection of utopian literature. It is utopian literature wherein we have defined the principles of government as worked out in fiction. And this, of course, begins in its representative things such as Atlantis, but also we have Flatland. and Looking Backwards, and the Bellamy novels. So here he has identified a body of material, most of which was uncollected until he began collecting it and putting it together. Now that he has collected it, a bibliography has been produced, there are collector imitators who will build their collections on the basis of that. But the creative collector is the one who identifies the body of material or recognizes certain patterns present in the production of literature in a certain period, or it doesn't, whatever definition he gives it, and then proceeds to prove his theory by collecting the books and building the collection.
You mentioned the creative collector. A couple of questions on that score. Is the world of rare books a world of high rollers financially?
Well, in some areas, yes, there are. The people who are in it for the investment motive, yes, you're going to find extraordinary prices being exchanged, six and seven figures.
Mm-hmm.
They exist, but we in university libraries don't have the luxury of competing. One day I was showing an important document to a university administrator, and I explained the price. They asked what the price was, and the comment was, "Oh, that's another full-time staff member."
For only 1 year.
For one year. But we have the book for a long time, and we can use it many times.
I teach a course in rare book librarianship, and one of the best collections, I've seen a number of fine collections brought together by students. One was a collection of books on saltwater fly fishing. That was his hobby, and he had a fine collection. An excellent collection I saw brought together for the simple price of postage stamps was a young woman who wrote to literally hundreds of historical societies throughout the United States asking whether they were engaged in historic preservation projects. If they were, would she be able to get a copy of their plans or documents or whatever they used for their historic preservation?
Rare book collections are so individual, and we can slice knowledge in so many ways. And as I say about our own collection at Duke, that we're able to look at it from so many points of view. It is as though it existed in the round, and I can peer through it from a number of angles. That's what makes it so exciting, because we are no longer treating it just for what it contains in terms of text or information. It's not like your dictionary, where you go look up a word or a little hand encyclopedia. Rather, it is a marvelous prism or gem that can be twisted in the light and refract so many areas, and that's the excitement of it. You may pick it up and examine it from one point of view, and I would examine it from another point of view, and I think that understanding about the rare book itself makes it probably the most exciting field that one can be in, but also you are going to learn new ways about perceiving the world through those who come to use the material.
You've been listening to Soundings, conversations with scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond. My guests were Paul Coda, curator of rare books at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and John Sharp, curator of rare books at Duke University. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities.